Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 9, delivered on September 19, 2017. The title of this lecture is Annuities and Perpetuities.
And again, I'll give you some information that will be useful to you a little later for the quiz. Tonight, annuities and perpetuities. Now, this subject was covered in your accounting class, but they, I believe, are still having you use tables to find factors, if I'm not mistaken. And we don't do that. We actually made it to the 21st century, and we use a calculator, and I will use as a reference calculator, the TI-83-84 series, hoping that you will use these because it's incredibly fast once you get the hang of it. And you can even do some problems that you're not supposed to be able to do. But the idea of an annuity is that most cash flows are not one-time events. In last week's lecture, I was showing you lump sums. But in this lecture, we deal with a stream of cash flows. A stream of cash flows is called an annuity. If the stream goes on forever, it's called a perpetuity. And I'll talk about those in the next lecture. They're actually, the formula is extremely easy for that one. Of cash flows that is forever is called a perpetuity. So, in other words, realistically, we might have a project that lasts from year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, and now at the end of the first year, we might have, let's say, $400 come from it. At the end of year 2, $500. The end of year 3, let's say 200. At the end of year 4, we have a final tail on it of $50. The realism of it is that, well, the part that's not all that real is that oftentimes we will assume that all the cash flows for a year occur at a given, just at a single point in time. We can sophisticate that if we want. There's not much reason to kill ourselves on it here. What we would like to know, for example, is how much that annuity is worth right now. We want to find the present value of it. Or alternately, we might want to know what the value of that annuity is at the end of it, a future value. A couple of things here. An annuity where each of the cash flows, each component occurs at the end of the period, that is called an ordinary annuity. If each of the components occurs at the beginning of the period, we call it an annuity due. This is important, and I'm going to show you something on the calculator here now that kind of emphasizes this. If we're going to use, well, we'll use two tonight, but one that we'll use, Apps Finance TVM Solver. Down here, this last toggle, PMT colon, end beginning. End is an ordinary annuity. Beginning is an annuity due. Now, the thing is that sometimes they'll tell you, but sometimes you just have to have common sense. So, for example, madam, if you set up payments for a car loan, would your payments be considered an ordinary annuity or an annuity due? Think about this. You get the car loan. Do you make your first payment immediately or a month later? Say it out loud. Yes, you make them a month later. So that would be an ordinary annuity. You, sir, one morning, your betrothed says, we are going to have a baby. And you run out screaming like a banshee, but no, you don't. The child is born, and you say, I have got to start preparing for this child's college education. I shall put in money starting today, and then every year, an amount of money, until you're 17, and then I'll let it ride to the end. Would that be an ordinary annuity or an annuity due? Yes, because the first payment occurs immediately. The cash flow stream that I put up here is an ordinary annuity. If I shifted each of those back so that the $400 occurred at year zero instead of year one, and at the end the $50 occurred at year three instead of at year four, that would be an annuity due. Again, sometimes they'll tell you, well, assume each cash flow occurs at the end of the period or whatever. Other times you just have to think about, well, what makes sense here about this? Now, one that is important to us is when each component is the same. We call that a level annuity. A level annuity. And that could be an ordinary or a due. But if each of the, so for example, your car payments or your home payments, that would be a level annuity and it would be ordinary. It would be an ordinary level annuity. Because each of your payments on the house or the car or whatever will be the same, so it's level, and you start making your payments at the end of the periods. That would be the ordinary part. Just a little bit of conceptual background for it. Stream of cash flows, annuity. Now, if I were really into math, I could do this, find the present value of this future expected cash flow, this annuity, by the lump sum formula method. Let's say that your discount rate is 6%. If I wanted to, I could just, in this case, I could just take each one back. About the only way, I'm going to show you a dirty trick for doing this. But in typical circumstances, you would take the present value of each of the future expected cash flows. So 400 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative first power plus 500 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative second power plus this gets to be a lot like work, 200 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative third power plus 50 times 1 plus 0.06 to the negative fourth power. Now, Excel spreadsheets can do this a lot faster. And if you take a higher level course, like 341, I'll show you how to do this with Excel. And it gets to be a little bit less painful to do this. But I'm going to do the present value of this, even though it's a kind of a pain in the backside. I'm going to quit this, and we'll just do it as a straight-up calculation, because later I'm going to show you a dirty trick for getting it that I'm not supposed to show. It's not even supposed to be known. Well, it's known, but it's not the way you're supposed to do it. But in this case, we have 400... times 1.06 to the negative first power plus 500 times 1.06 to the negative second power plus 200 times 1.06 to the negative third power plus 50 times 1.06 to the negative fourth power. If I keyed that in right, survey says $1,029.89. Okay, that is what, now notice, 400 plus 500 is 900, plus 200 is 1100, 1150. So the present value of the cash flow is going to be less than just the sum of the cash flows because of the discounting. Notice something else about this. First of all, a lot of projects, you start a new product and you want to estimate what the present value of that project is. What that product is. These can be very long. Some products last for a couple of years, but a lot of products last for the ages. In fact, if you go into the generic section or the low price section of some stores, like a Walmart or a Meijer, you'll see these brands that look, they're low priced. You don't ever hear anything about them. Back a long time ago, those were the cream of the crop. Those were the high-end products. But the company doesn't kill the product. It just lets it kind of die out into the competitive environment. It stops advertising to keep it in the public's mind. Things like Timex watches, Prell shampoo. I got a whole universe of products have these very long cash flows that go on and on. For years and years and years. And we find present value. We assume the product will have its big heyday, and then it'll begin to mature, and then it'll go into its decline, and then it'll just go into its sort of like its stasis phase. Notice something about present value analysis like this, and I've said this before, and it's very important now. Projects that have their major cash flow way out here, it takes a long time for money of any kind to be generated, but once it generates, it's pretty big out here. They don't get accepted by normal companies because the discounting of something way out here 30, 40 years is so steep that they're not really, most companies would say no. That's why there are companies that are very large, the oligopolies, are more likely to do those because they are strategic analysts. Oligopolies tend to be strategic in their planning. They would be the ones who will be preparing for the huge, insanely large cash flows 30, 40 years out with asteroid mining or with entertainment centers in near-Earth orbit. Or things like that, or the fusion reactors that will replace these nasty fission reactors. The fusions are clean, and you can make a fortune off them, but God, the cash flow is way out there. So when you do a present value of those cash flows, it's practically nothing. So that normal companies wouldn't take on those kinds of big projects. You, as young, very young people, your big cash flows are going to happen years after you're born. So there's an incentive not to invest in you at your early ages because the cash flow is so far out in the future, so its present value isn't that strong. Okay, anyway, I'm going to keep that on the board because that kind of is there. Like I said, I'm going to show you a trick a little later for doing this without that sum of additions. But for now, the thing though is, let's talk ordinary annuities. Let's talk about level annuities. They are actually not that unusual. We talk about them, for example, in financial planning. Putting away a certain amount of money every year, how much are you going to have after a certain number of years? So, you get your first job, and immediately start saving $100. No, let's do $1,000 per year at an APR of, let's say 6.2%. How much will you have in 20 years? This one's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. Apps. I wish I could make this bigger. Let me turn down the lights a little bit. That'll help. Now, first of all, you see this is level. It's a level annuity because each of the cash flow components will be the same. No big thing there. The second thing you want to assess is, was this an ordinary annuity or is this an annuity due? Call it, sir. Is this an ordinary or annuity or an annuity due? Yes, because you're putting your first one in right away. And then the last one will ride. So 0 through 9 makes the 0 through 19, and then that whole plug rides out to 20 when you can pull it out. So we're going to go apps, finance, TVM solver. So N here is going to be 20 years. The I percent, it's annual. By the way, oftentimes with annuities, there is the implicit of how many periods per year. In this case, it's just going to be one period per year, so it's just divided by one. Now, there is no present value in this one. You would have a PV if there were some amount of money as a kicker up front. But here, we're not going to start with some big, huge plug of money. We're just going to do $1,000 payments every year. And then we're going to find the future value of it. But first, don't ever forget this, because it's really easy to set it on one and then forget where you've set it for the next problem. This is an annuity due, so you hit the begin toggle. Now we're going to go back up to the FV, future value, alpha, solve. There you go, $39,916.70. $39,916.70. $916.70, is it? Yeah. Look at that. That's almost double the amount that you actually physically put in. $1,000 per year for 20 years, and you end up at the end of the 20 years with almost 40 grand. You've doubled your money in that period of time. So that's not bad. That gives you an idea of how we execute financial planning, because we have people who say, well, I want to be able to buy this in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. And so we set up the discipline. You put this in the bank with every paycheck, and this, you will hit your goal with the accounts that we set up, with the yields on the accounts that we set up for you. So we achieve the goals this way. Very realistically, you just put in the right amount of money and you're out of and you're done. Good news on that. So now, let's say, well, let's do a completely different problem here. And for this, I'm going to have to bring up a search engine. And ask just a brief question. What do you think? Sir, what's the car of your dreams? What do you want for a car? Now, don't go stupid crazy on me. I want a Ferrari, man. No, you don't get a Ferrari. I don't get one, so you don't get one. Okay, so what's a car that would be realistic but something that you like? A Mustang? Okay, that's reasonable. Someone said a Chevy in the last class. A what? A Chevy? No. Okay, a Mustang. I mean, you'll probably crash and kill yourself, but it'll be a good death. Okay, let's say you want a Mustang. Let's find out. From 25,185. That would be probably, they'd give you a steering wheel with it. So putting it up there at a more realistic, let's say about 28 grand, okay? So let's find out. You go to the dealership and say, I should like to buy this Mustang, and I want monthly payments for 5 years. 5 years times 12 months per year. You don't need to hit enter, just go down. Now, the dealer says we got an APR of 4.99%. But these are monthly, so you'll have to do 4.99 divided by 12. Now, the present value is what you're going to be lent. A little notation here. This has been true of calculators, financial calculators, since time immemorial. Present values you always put in as a negative amount. Don't ask me why, it's just how you do it. And you'll always get a present value out as a negative amount. So just don't forget to put in a negative there. $28,000. Now, there is no future value because there's no kicker at the end you have to pay. So that's just a zero. And this is, like most consumer loans, just an ordinary annuity, so we toggle end. And now we go back up to the payment, and we say alpha solve. $520.27 a month. That would be your payments. $520.27. Now, I'm going to show you something about consumer financing. What they would probably do is say, how much do you take home minus your bills already that you pay every month? And let's compare that to $520 at 25% of your income. So you'll have to have about $2,080, is that? After you've paid all your other bills. has. If you have that disposable income remaining, we'll make you the loan. That's your credit threshold. They do that with all kinds of consumer loans, like home loans. They'll say, all right, that after you've paid all your other bills, is this payment going to be less than or equal to 25% or a 33%, something like that, of your remaining disposable income? So if you can muster this amount of money, you can have that Mustang, and you can have friends. Okay? That's just a straight-up consumer loan. Going back in here, just one more. I want to do this so that you're comfortable. Okay. Apps. Wait. Let me clear this out. Okay, apps, finance, TVM solver. Now, I feel like let's make a deal tonight. You want to have a nice home. Not necessarily a dream home, but not a hovel. Maybe a dream hovel. You know, what do you think you would pay in a nice neighborhood in Chicagoland? I'm not talking Rockford. I'm not talking Naperville. I'm talking a nice neighborhood. Schaumburg, something like that. What do you think you'd buy for, let's say, a 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath, 2-story? Just tell me what you know or... Ow! 350. Okay, we're going to go low end. We'll do some... Yeah, you call me. I'll do some DIY, you know. It might not hold, but it'll hold long enough for me to get away with the money you pay me. Okay. You go to a bank and you do a 30-year fixed rate mortgage with monthly payments. And they give you an APR on this one of 5.29%. And you divide that by 12. And I'm just doing this over and over so that you get the hang of it. If you got the calculator, for heaven's sakes, follow along with me. Price value is going to be negative $350,000. And we check FE, all these, make sure everything is straight up for the rest of them. And now we're going to go down to the payment, and we're going to say alpha solve. Whoa! $1,941.39. 1941.39. Okay, now I'm going to quit this. Let's see how much you have to have disposable after all your other bills to handle this. 1941.39. Okay? Divided by, let's say that they're going to hold you at a threshold of 30%. You would have to have an income, monthly income, after you paid all your other bills, take home minus your credit card payments, your car payments, of $6,471. And that ain't going to happen for a while in most people's lives. But now let's take this trick the other way. This is how you would go into deal with a car dealership without getting blindsided. Let's say that you have already done the calculations, and after all of your other bills are paid, you've paid your student loan payments, you've paid your credit card bills, your utility bills, your net disposable. Let's say that you work that out to be $1,800 a month. That's what you have. So in other words, you can afford a payment. The bank would say yes to you if your payment is less than or equal to 1,800 times 25%. Watch what I'm going to do here. I'm going to say 1,800. I know the bank is going to do this. They're going to make me calculate my take-home pay minus all of my other bills. That comes up to be $1,800. Okay, what payment would be 25%? $450 a month. Remember that number. Now we're going to go apps, finance, TVM solver. And we're going to go backwards. A five-year loan, monthly payments, 5 times 12 for N. They told me that I could get a loan with them for 5.69% APR, and so we'll divide that by 12 periods per month. We're going to leave the PV alone, say, all right, this says that I can afford, what was that, $450 a month? This thing said I could afford $450 a month payments. So let's see what the car company will lend me by going up to PV, the price, alpha, sol. I could go in there and get a $23,450 car and meet the bank's threshold. This way, you can go in and you know where the yes or no would be. So I know that they're going to be okay if I have a payment of $450 a month or less, about. So that means, by my calculations, I can get about a $23,000 car. And in fact, you could even go to your credit union or your bank and say, I want to be pre-approved for $23,000. They'd run the calculation. They say, yes, that meets our threshold. Then you go into the dealership and you say, I like that car. If you can make it happen at $23,000 or less, the bank's already approved me. That's pre-approval. That's real pre-approval. Not this phony stuff you see in the scam mail. Okay? That's how you do it. This is where what I'm doing actually has real life use to you. Real world stuff can be talked about here in this kind of finance. This is actually partly consumer finance, partly corporate finance, because in corporate we do the same thing. How much leverage can we afford before we get the creditors, the bondholders, and the underwriters to start getting a little bit fussy with us? Now I'm going to do something that I just should not do. See that problem that I started with? For the most part, the TVM solver works with level annuities. Level annuities ordinary, level annuities do. But there is a facility that allows you to work with non-level annuities. Don't ask me why, just do this, okay? Apps, finance. Go down to selection 7. It's the NPV. Enter. Now just do it the way I tell you. And you can actually crank. I mean, you could go years. As long as you don't get tired of typing in the numbers, you don't have to do the calculations. First thing you're going to want to put in is the interest rate per period. In this case, they're yearly, so it's just 6%. Now you key in the comma. Make sure you do the comma. And the next thing you put in is a zero. Now, this should be used for a cost up front, but we're not doing it for that. We're saying there's nothing up front. And now you put in a comma, and the next thing you do is open braces, second parenthesis. And then you put in each cash flow component, 400, comma, 500, comma, 200, comma. How much would that lot? 50? And then, after the last one, you close the braces, and then you close that parentheses that started the whole thing.
Well, spank me Buddha. Look at that. Isn't that what I... Yeah, that's, hey, what do you know? I got it right. And I didn't have to do... See, when you do the arithmetic of it, you're always prone to... You're always prone to making arithmetic mistakes, keying in something wrong, and all that. The nice thing about these apps like this is that you still could accidentally put a parenthesis for a brace or forget a comma or put in a number wrong. But the number of possible mistakes you could make is considerably fewer. Okay? Now, you never saw this from me, but this is a lot faster. Now, in your accounting classes, you were taught to do present values and future values using factor tables. Am I correct on that? They showed you these tables? Yeah. We don't do it that way. We're finance people. We're lazy. We want to have time to go out and actually have a life. I shouldn't say that, because we all used tables back in the day, but the calculator, just these calculator things just make it so much easier for us to do these kinds of problems like this. And you can even do some weird things too. In the next lecture, I'll show you some tricks. Finance textbooks love to show you these kind of present values and future values you can calculate doing some really strange stuff. It's sort of like doing Venn diagrams almost, and I'll show you those in the next lecture. But something that I want to make sure that we get through tonight, before I do anything else, is I want to make sure that you know some websites that are worth your knowledge, worth your time. In case you have one of those ReggieNet in-class quizzes show up tonight, hint, hint, it might be worth your while to know some sites. How did that happen? Oh, duh. I had it typed in, and now I'm going to have to find it again. See this site right here? You might want to write down that URL. Can I make this actually bigger? I can't. Oh, I know what I can do. Where's my word? Oh, clear down there at the bottom. That might be worth your while, that site right there. And no, I'm not going to read the letters to you, because the point of this is, if you're here, it's going to be a lot easier for you to answer some questions. Some of them might be just as stupid. What was the yield on a one-year treasury bill on September the 15th? Or what was the yield on a 30-year treasury bond on January the 27th? Of 2017. All you have to do is look it up and put the answer. That might be one thing. Are you okay on that? For the love of God, some of you are taking pictures of it. If we're ever attacked by the Russians, we're dead. In Soviet Russia, we write things down before we kill you. Anyway, whatever. Okay, so I'm going to get that off the board. Now, this site, by the way, you can choose a lot of the whole year if you need to look at something. And don't forget what I had said for you, like, for example, the reference rate. When corporate bonds are issued, if they are good if they go through one of the services like Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, the bond is given a rating. Now, the highest quality bonds are AAA, at least in one rating service. And what we have are what are called reference rates. Now, a reference rate would be the prevailing rate on a specific grade of bond. So the reference rate, let's say the reference rate right now at 9.18.17, AAA corporate investment grade is, let's say, 4.85% for a 30-year corporate AAA. In other words, right now, the best of the best bonds that are 30 years in duration is 4.80%. This is good, for example, if I am a very high-powered corporation, I'm going to get a AAA rating on my bonds. That way, when we do the deal with the lenders, we know that the coupon should be probably right at about 4.85% on the coupon. It tells us what we would offer the lenders that would get us to sell the bonds to them at par. $1,000. If we were to set the coupon lower than that, well, then those investors would not lend us $1,000. They'd lend us less than $1,000 per bond. If we set the bond coupon rate higher than that, well, then the lenders would give us more than $1,000. That sounds great until you realize that that means that I'd be stuck with like a 5% coupon in a 4.85% environment. So anyway, that's a reference rate. Now, let me show you what that means. How we can use that. And I've said this one before, and I'm just emphasizing. I want you to look at a 30-year Treasury bond. Do you see its yield right there? Okay. The yield on a 30-year Treasury bond is 2.80%. The best of the private sector versus a completely riskless, well, almost completely riskless, Treasury, government-backed debt security. So if I take 4.85% minus 2.80%, I get 2.05%. So I can now say the credit risk spread at 30 years is 205 basis points. The credit risk spread at 30 years right now stands at 205 basis points on the 30-year. That has meaning to it. Private debt, no matter how high its quality, is riding about 205 basis points against public debt of completely riskless quality. Now, we like to keep an eye on that as time goes on. How does that credit risk spread open and close as time goes on? It tells us about the business environment, the sentiments about riskiness of maturity, the volatility of interest rates. For now, All you need to do is know how to get the credit risk spread. Because I can't say that it would ever be asked of you, but it might be asked of you on a certain in-class quiz that's coming up. You following with me? Yahtzee. Okay, now. Going back here, just very quickly, I'm repeating this. From the beginning of the year, a one-year treasury bill, which is sort of like a benchmark, 1 year out, if you had lent the government money for 1 year, you would get $1,000 back. You would have lent them like $990. You get $1,000 back in a year. The yield would have been 0.89%. That was at the beginning of this year. Let's carry it down to right now. Tonight, the yield on a one-year treasury stands at 1.31%. So from the beginning of the year, the yield on a benchmark one-year treasury bill has risen 42 basis points. The benchmark has risen, the one-year benchmark has risen 42 basis points. Now, you'd say, all right, that's wonderful. Is that really that much? That is actually a lot. Because 42 basis points rising off 89 basis points is about a 46% jump in interest rates. That will have an effect on the economy. First shockwave we're already seeing. We're seeing weakness in retail sales going into the holiday season. We're seeing the labor market actually tightening up. Labor hiring is still going on, which is going to put inflationary pressure, but as the Fed clamps down, there won't be any way to hire at those higher wages. We're beginning to see the origins of a recession. Okay? So, keep this in mind if I said, okay, how many basis points has a seven-year risen from the first trading day of the year until the 17th or the 18th? You would look at this table. I'm getting you to the point where you know where to look for financial information, and getting you away from idiotic sites like Investopedia and Wikipedia. The origins of the data are here, not where some weirdo recopies and pastes stuff in some suspect website. This is where you go to get it. Okay, so that's that. And it's worth you knowing. Now I want to finish with one last weird thing. And I can turn this back on for a while here. I'm going to take you back into the darkness of your past, into another place you were earlier that was unhappy, that caused you to have weird things so that you had to go on Oprah Winfrey and tell about your bad childhood. Justifies your psychotic rages and your desire to eat Spam sandwiches at 3 a.m. I am talking about high school algebra. What if I were to say, and this goes back to a simple lump sum problem. I want to make sure that I cover that in this class tonight. What if someone were to say,
You invest $2,500 at an APR of, let's say, 5.8%. Notice I didn't say compounding, so there's nothing, if I don't say anything about it or there's no implication that there were monthly or daily or then it's not there. How long would it take to double your money? Your investment. Simple enough question. And I get it kind of asked, I've had it asked me, well, if I put this much in the bank, when can I pull it out and it'll be twice as big? Okay, well, let's see. It would be the future value equals the present value times 1 plus R all to the T power. It's just a simple lump sum. I know the future value I want is $5,000. I know the present value is $2,500. I know it's 1 plus 0.058 to the T power. I don't know the number of years. Since you're the one who wanted to know this, how do I solve this? How do you solve for an exponent, for an unknown exponent? Say it. That's good. That's solving. How? First thing you do is, as I used to teach math. I taught it for 10 years at Ohio State. And I tell, getting people used to algebra, you peel the onion back, the most vulnerable layer at a time. The most vulnerable thing is this 2,500 sitting there. It's just a time symbol. It's saying, kill me. So I'm going to just divide both sides by 2,500, and that leaves me with 2 equals 1.085, and I'm going to do that internal thing right there. 2, I asked about doubling. See, it really wouldn't matter how much money you started with. The doubling, it would be, if it said triple, I could have just said 3 equals and got rid of the actual numbers. Okay, now, work it, girl. Oh, the pressure's on. I am Alex Trebek. You know, silver-haired, wearing a very expensive suit. I lie. I'm not Alex Trebek. I'm more like Joe Black. Okay? Got it? You know? Okay. Sir, you're looking at me like, I got nothing. Okay. Anyone want to tell me? Go. Square root. Both of you are, yeah? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Oh, my. Animal. The way you solve for exponents is you use logarithms. Logarithms, watch, I'm going to do a log of both sides. Natural log 2 equals natural log 1.085 to the T power. Now, I could use any log. The reason I use the natural log is because it's on the calculator. The common log, base 10, is on the calculator too. You could have used any log. It's just an ln natural log and log common log are on your calculator. The reason we do this is because once they're natural logs, I can say an exponent, a natural log of a number to an exponent is the exponent times the natural log. Natural logs have that really sweet little trick that an exponent can be peeled off and put out front.
That's the only reason we use natural. Well, okay, there are other reasons, but the biggest reason for ever using a natural log, other than to impress your friends and family, is so that you can strip an unknown power off and stick it on the front. So now I've got just natural log of 2 over the natural log of 1.085 equals t. That's all you use. Again, there are other reasons you use natural log. If you get into some really high-powered stuff, they show up all over the place. Weird how useful they are. Little background. The fellow in the end of the 1600s who invented natural logs, and they are an invention. They're just a trick. Everyone claimed he was going. His greatest fame, about the only thing he was really remembered for, was his natural logs. Well, near the end of the 16th century, he was dying of madness. He was going crazy. He actually believed when he died that his greatest contribution to the world was going to be that he predicted that the end of it would happen on the first day of the 18th century. 1701, on the first day, the world would end, and everyone would remember him for that. Shows you how crazy it was. If he'd been right, everyone would have been dead, and no one would have remembered him. But he just completely, he thought those logarithms, he said, no one will ever remember me for that. Anyway, watch. Okay, now here's the last thing that's important about this. Is first of all, seriously? Okay. Natural log 2. You could use log 2. It doesn't matter which one you use. 2. Close the parentheses. Divided by the natural log of 1.085. Close the parentheses. 8.4965 years. You got the number of years to double. But hold on a minute. You're saying to me, yes. Oh, 8.5? Oh, 5. Okay, you're right. Yeah, I was going to say, that seemed like an awfully short number of years. You're right, thank you. Log 2 divided by log 1.058. I thought it'd be more like about 11 years, maybe. Maybe a little more than that. 12 years, okay. Thank you. That actually works a little better, too. 12.2941 years. But you're saying, well, wait a minute. Who says years in decimal? So, if you know this, I'm boring you, but if you don't know this trick, watch this. First thing, we'll take off 12 years, minus 12. So we keep the 12 years, and we got 0.2941 of another year. Now, in order to turn that into days, we times that by 365 days per year, that residue. So now I can say, in fact, it is 12 years, 107.3577 days. And you're saying to yourself, not good enough for me. So it's 12 years, and then I subtract off the 107 days, and I got 0.35765 of a day. So now I can multiply that by 24 hours in a day. And it's 12 years, 107 days, 8.5837 hours. And you're saying, still not good enough, fat boy. Minus 8 hours. You want accuracy? I'll give you accuracy. So, 0.5658 of a day times 60 minutes. 12 years, whatever. That's all I have for you. I thank you.